to the final case this morning, which is Brian Brown versus Elizabeth Bowman et al.
May it please the court. The lower court invoked Rooker-Feldman doctrine to dismiss this case. I am Brian Brown, representing myself. This court should reverse and find that Rooker-Feldman is no bar to jurisdiction because, one, the complaint asks the federal court to review no state court orders or final judgments. Number two, the complaint makes credible allegations of a state court process that violated federal civil rights, including the right to be judged by a tribunal uncontaminated by politics. And finally, three, the complaint seeks remedies against the defendants that could not be obtained in the state court proceedings, since the defendants in this action were not the defendants in that action. The Honorable Teresa Springman described this case as one alleging government biases against religious beliefs that resulted in the denial of a license to practice law. With all due respect, I've lost more than a good moral character certification. There have been reports generated that have been put into the National Data Bank, I believe, and I do allege that could affect me in other states in gaining admission. And I have been through multiple torts during the process, underlying actions that have nothing to do with actually the state question of whether I have good moral character. This court's Supreme Court blessed Gash case, and the exception to Rooker-Feldman found in Nessus v. Shepard is really on the docket today. At root, Gash and Nessus asked whether some independent right was violated by the state court action. A claim of the right to be judged by a tribunal uncontaminated by politics is at bar. Bar applicants should not be evaluated by, or should be rather, evaluated by seasoned attorneys seeking the best in due process, attorneys schooled in the constitutional rights and responsibilities of the peerage to the law licensure, not government social workers and their handpicked mental health consultants. Instead of being evaluated by a bar committee attorney sworn to defend the Constitution and thus earning absolute immunity, applicant 24-128 was remanded to mental health inquisitors with mere qualified immunity, who ordered him to quote no constitutional law or suffer negative consequences. What laws should JLAP have been happy to hear in these circumstances? None as much as the Baird Court's stern 1971 warning that, quote, views and beliefs are immune from bar association inquisitions, designed to lay a foundation for barring an applicant from the practice of law. As the facts clearly show, the applicant's views and beliefs and his inability to demonstrate the desired empathy toward those views and beliefs cherished by his government handlers cost him the coveted good moral character certification from JLAP. The applicant's views, beliefs, and religious sentiments are discussed in the Ross Report, the Bowman Report, and both Sidrovich reports that tendered those to the state government. Bowman probed empathy as to her beliefs and wrote up her own client for failing to agree with her on abortion, religion, and the benefits of postmodern psychotherapy. The theme of empathy struck a sympathetic chord with JLAP's principal handler, the social worker Tim Sidrovich, who repeatedly refused to meet the applicant but still justified flunking him for certification through JLAP for exhibiting, quote, a lack of empathy regarding, quote, issues associated with his beliefs. What laws should JLAP's inquisitors have gladly respected? The 1957 Schwer Court rule of engagement stating that, quote, mere unorthodoxy in the field of politics and social ideas does not, as a matter of fair and logical inference, negate good moral character. An applicant's refusal to adopt positivism as political orthodoxy and refusal to agree with JLAP's concepts of the best in contemporary social ideals should not result in four reports reporting the applicant as morally or mentally unacceptable, as they did in the case at bar. What constitutional framework did JLAP seem to miss through all this? The Schwer Court's mandate that a state cannot exclude a person from the practice of law or from other occupation in a manner or for reasons that contravene the due process or equal protection clause. That directive was followed by the practical note in the Schwer Court that an applicant could not be excluded merely because he was a Republican or a member of a particular church. A Republican? Church, these are terms of ideology. The Supreme Court long ago hammered out a detente as to ideology in the processing of bar applicants, mostly, quite honestly, so that Marxists and Christians could all just get along. The detente was fully expressed in the 1971 Baer decision ordering the states to end, quote, inquisitions about beliefs and associations and refusals to let people practice law and hold public office or even private jobs solely because of public authorities have been suspicious of their ideas. That almost 40-year-old detente has been violated in the processing of applicant 24128 through JLAP, and the result is, according to the Swear Court, quote, invidious discrimination. But further directive, should every JLAP official, mental health agent, have to memorize Justice Frankfurter's 1957 solemn warning that, quote, judicial action, even in an individual case, may be based on avowed considerations that are inadmissible in that they violate the requirements of due process? Is there evidence of unreasonable due process, a bar that can be laid at the defendant's feet? The non-IBLA defendants? Absolutely. The confiscation of work product, the refusal to respond to an IBLA subpoena, tendering of hearsay-laden reports, denial of cross-examination, Sidorovich's repeated refusal to meet personally with the applicant he was evaluating, repeated refusal to appoint a mentor that had been offered and accepted, guessing an applicant's motivation and likely future actions in licensure analysis, interference with contract, the tendering of non-witness, non-testimonial reports to an Indiana court, directives to misdiagnose, frustration of the development of the applicant's expert witnesses, witness refusal to investigate civil rights complaints, billing fraud, state constitutional violations, and the filing of admittedly falsified reports to government bodies in Indiana as well as the national database. These parade of horribles all occurred in a subset of the time I was processed, just the time I was before JLAP. And I believe these facts allow the court to revisit Whitfield v. the Illinois Board of Law Examiners. I would ask this court to make the most of these facts. Thank you.
Counsel. Brandenburg.
May it please the court. The first issue that I would like to address is the judicial corruption exception to the Rooker-Feldman doctrine contained in the Nessies and Laubser cases. Mr. Brown brought up this argument for the first time in his reply, and for that reason the appellees request that the court consider that argument waived. Although he did cite to the Nessies case in his initial brief, he only cited to this for the purpose of arguing that if he shows there's a separate injury, he still has a claim and it's outside of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. He was not arguing judicial corruption. Notwithstanding the waiver, the judicial corruption exception does not apply on the basis that Mr. Brown has not alleged that the Indiana Board of Law Examiners or the Indiana Supreme Court were corrupted. Those were the final decision makers in this case. As the court below was correct in determining, the thrust of Mr. Brown's case is that JLAP discriminated against him in providing biased evaluations, and these evaluations were eventually reviewed by the Indiana Board of Law Examiners and the Indiana Supreme Court, resulting in a denial of his bar admission. In order to review these claims, the district court would necessarily have to go through a process of reviewing not only the claims at issue and the actions of JLAP, but the process used by the Indiana Board of Law Examiners and the Indiana Supreme Court in reaching their final decision on his bar admission. Mr. Brown has failed to provide this court with any reasoning as to why this court should move away from its previous decisions in Edwards and Hale. Particularly, he's argued that Edwards is distinct on the basis that in that case, the plaintiff filed suit against the wrong parties and asked for the wrong relief. But looking at that case, it's much closer to this case than plaintiff allows. In Edwards, the plaintiff was requesting not an overturn of the Illinois Supreme Court's decision to deny her admission to the bar, but instead was seeking a finding that the Character and Fitness Committee's requirement to release her mental health records was a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. She argued that this was a separate injury. This is similar to what Mr. Brown is claiming in the present case. Mr. Brown is claiming that simply having to go through the evaluation process was a separate injury, even though the only injury that could have resulted from that is the fact that his bar admission was denied. So in determining whether the Rooker-Feldman doctrine applies, the court needs to ask, is Mr. Brown's injury separate from the Indiana Supreme Court's final decision to deny his admission to the bar? And here it's not. If the Indiana Supreme Court had granted him admission to the bar, there would be no injury. Mr. Brown has also tried to argue that the due process of the Indiana Supreme Court and the Indiana Board of Law Examiners was insufficient for him to bring forward his claims of religious discrimination, and thus those claims are not a part of the final decision of the Indiana Supreme Court. This is much like what the plaintiff in Hale argued in arguing that the Character and Fitness Committee's hearing process was merely administrative and thus did not give him an opportunity to voice his concerns of discrimination. The judicial process created by the Indiana Supreme Court provides full due process protections to applicants. In this case, Mr. Brown's evaluation was completed by JLAP and the evaluators, Drs. Ross and Bowman. This evaluation was then provided to the Indiana Board of Law Examiners, where they had an opportunity to review that application and make an initial decision to deny his petition and application. At that point, under Rule 9 of the Indiana Admission and Discipline Rules, he had the opportunity to request a full hearing. At that hearing, Mr. Brown had the opportunity to not only subpoena witnesses and subpoena documents, but be represented by counsel. If he had chosen to take opportunity to use his subpoena power, he could have even called Drs. Ross and Bowman to cross-examine them, which is one of his complaints of injury.
And we know that he made the same constitutional arguments regarding bias at that juncture?
Yes.
Right. That's what I understood. I don't know that we have a record of that. But the argument was made.
Correct. And the district court below did not look at the evidence that was submitted, including his petition to the United States Supreme Court, along with the Indiana Board of Law Examiners' recommendations. However, those recommendations can be reviewed, as this is a jurisdictional question which allows the court to go outside of his complaint. But his complaint also makes allegations that his claims of discrimination were brought to the Indiana Board of Law Examiners' attention, I believe in paragraphs 88 and paragraphs 129, where he states that he wrote letters to the Indiana Board of Law Examiners claiming that the Drs. Ross and Bowman were being discriminatory in conducting their evaluations.
What kind of a decision does the Board of Law Examiners issue on something like this? Just a summary denial, or is there an explanation?
Actually, in this case, the Board of Law Examiners issued a fairly long recommendation to the Indiana Supreme Court after completing the whole hearing.
And do we have that in the record? Is that publicly accessible?
That was attached to Mr. Brown's petition to the United States Supreme Court, which is
okay.
In the record.
So we do have that.
Correct.
Okay.
Unless the court has any other questions, he did have the opportunity then to petition the Indiana Supreme Court, where he again brought forward the claims of religious discrimination. That is also in the record. But he has had the opportunity to have these claims heard. They're a part of the final decision of the Indiana Supreme Court and a part of the judicial process for that reason.
And the court itself issued a decision with an explanation, or is that just a summary decision?
The Indiana Supreme Court issued a decision simply affirming
okay.
the position of the Indiana Board of Law Examiners. But in the Hale decision, this court specifically stated that a full order explaining their reasoning does not mean the court has not provided complete judicial review.
Thank you, Mr. Brandenburg.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Brown, how much time? You have 3 minutes, Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, the Indiana Supreme Court's half-page, six-sentence order merely says the applicant's petition for review is denied. And the actual IBLE's writings make the case that this could be, in the spirit of Justice John Paul Stevens, the Yick Wo dissent that he had looked for a long time ago. The Honorable Court could build off Justice Paul Stevens' cogent and concise Feldman dissent, which opined that a future bar applicant would appear with a fact pattern comparable to Yick Wo v. Hopkins and demonstrate the deep flaw at the heart of the Feldman opinion, a deep flaw that's already been corrected to some extent by Exxon v. Mobil. Res judicata used to work for Rooker Feldman. It doesn't anymore. A lot of other things used to work for Rooker Feldman. It doesn't anymore. We're down to basically Gash, Nesses in the Seventh, and the Ninth Circuit has another. But we've been told three times by the High Court we need to ratchet Rooker-Feldman back. And this case presents this court with the opportunity to do that again, as it did in Gash. Gash has been cited 770 times. Gash has been cited glowingly by the United States Supreme Court, and this case could help follow Gash up. You'll find a fact pattern strikingly similar to Yick Wo in my verified complaint and ancillary affidavit that's been put in at ECR 57. My petition for certiorari to the SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, spells out in detail the Yikwo analogies, as that I built the entire thing on the idea that I had seen and documented an evil eye and unequal hand in the way I'd been processed. I was remanded into JLAP on January 25th, 2008. Tim Sidrovich remanded me back to the IBLE on January 22nd, 2009, a year in JLAP under qualified immunity, not absolute immunity, under the control of these evaluators who refused to certify me for the bar, and the IBLE said, well, that's enough for me. He wasn't certified by the evaluators. I recently joined the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and I thank you that you made that decision in about 5 days. But more than that, I thank you that I wasn't handed over to federal marshals to be taken down to a canal to determine what my views on church and state were, because we don't do that in America. I was treated in a way in which it shouldn't be done in America. And I ask this court to see that I am not stuck on Rooker-Feldman, and I have a right to pursue remedies against the defendants. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thanks to counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.